You're listening to How to Build a Better World, the Fifth Estate podcast where we call on the experts and leaders to explore the big ecological, social, and financial problems of our time.
Hi, I'm Tina Perinotto, editor of The Fifth Estate, and this is How to Build a Better World. Today I'm talking to Ainsley Simpson, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Infrastructure Sustainability Council. Now, the council is a purpose-driven, member-based peak body ensuring infrastructure delivers social, cultural, environmental, and economic benefits. This is one of those podcasts that I've wanted to do for a long time, not the least because at The Fifth Estate, we are endlessly fascinated by the massive consumption of carbon that big infrastructure projects such as roads and bridges consume, but also the ability of these done sustainably to save massive amounts of carbon. But Ainsley tells us that her organisation does so much more, just like infrastructure is so much more. Today I'm speaking to Ainsley Simpson from Infrastructure Sustainability Council. So welcome, Ainsley, to the podcast.
Thank you, Tina. I'm delighted to be here.
It's really great you could join us. So, Ainsley, we were just talking before we started recording about what the world's looking like from your end. Would you give us a bit of a broad picture? It's a time of great flux, of course, and great interest in sustainability. And infrastructure sort of looms really large on the environment and in the economy. But I have to confess that from our perspective on the Fifth Estate, it's always been a bit of a mystery to us. And I don't think we've grappled with it or kind of understood it in a very clear way. And I think it's because of the scale of it. And, you know, a few years ago, I was talking to an engineer who'd moved from the building sector to the infrastructure sector. And he said to me, Tina, you've got no idea. He said, you know, we're really, you know, chuffed in the building sector if we save a few hundred, you know, kilos of carbon. But when you're talking about infrastructure, you're talking about hundreds of thousands. And I'm going, oh my God, he's right. We've got to take this more seriously than we do. And I think maybe it's because we kind of associate infrastructure with roads and bridges, but it's so much more. And these things are going to be built anyway, I know. So Ainsley, can you sort of tell us what we don't know about infrastructure and what the scenario is looking like at the moment from your point of view?
Tina, it's been a really important time for us for reflection. It's been a decade since the then Infrastructure Minister, Anthony Albanese, launched the Infrastructure Sustainability Rating Scheme. And as part of this decade of determination, we actually paused and asked ourselves, what is infrastructure? And it is complex. It is quite colossal in some aspects, and there are all sorts of definitions out there. You know, it could be horizontal and vertical, it could be economic and social, but in exploring it, what we now use as our definition is that infrastructure is a network of systems, interconnected systems. So if you think about it, we've got connective systems like transport and communication, we've got supportive systems like energy, power, and waste management. And we've got the blue and the green systems, which are all of the natural, the natural systems, which provide really important ecosystem services. And then we've also got those livable systems, those that are providing health, education, our residential, our place of work. So I think it's quite helpful to think about it in that way.
That's huge. It's absolutely huge and includes so much more than I think the ordinary person, i.e. us, might think about.
Yeah. Well, it's quite a helpful way to think about it because when you think about the purpose of infrastructure, all of those systems are there to enable people. And the other big aha moment that we had is that infrastructure is for people, by people, and it enables people to thrive. That was a big realization. It was a piece of thought leadership that we did together with the brilliant placemaker, Kate Marrick from Urbis. But putting that all together, we recognized that infrastructure has got such a fundamental part in building vibrant cities, vibrant societies, vibrant regions, but more importantly, vibrant nations. So it is complex, it is interconnected. And the easiest way to think about it is that it's a system.
That's fantastic. So are your members, you know, are they sort of fully across this concept of infrastructure across all these different fields?
Well, we're quite fortunate in that our members span across the whole value chain of infrastructure. So we've got organisations that are financiers, we've got asset owners and operators, we've got all levels of government, from local to central or federal, state, territories, all of the most progressive transport agencies, many departments that are responsible for policy or regulation, and then also the supply chain. Services organisations, contractors, manufacturers, other peak bodies, and of course universities. So there's a really broad church of organisations that are part of our membership, and they're, you know, a growing number of them. We're growing at about 40 to 50% a year. We've got over 220 now. And they all have a different place to start. They're all on their own journeys, and they've all got a very different perspective about what sustainability means for them.
That's fantastic. And so this kind of broader definition of infrastructure, is that kind of something that's evolving over time? Because I'm pretty sure in the olden days it used to be roads and bridges, mostly, and trains, I suppose. Is that something that's been evolving over the years?
I think it's also... public good.
Ainsley, would you mind repeating that? Because I just lost a connection and we'll be able to fix that in the editing. Sorry. So, Ainsley, would you be able to tell us, is that idea of infrastructure in the broader sense and the more sustainable sense as well, including green infrastructure and people, is that something that's been evolving over the years, in the recent years?
It's definitely been evolving, and I think that that has been helped along by the fact that we require different systems and different support as our populations grow, and particularly our cities, but increasingly the inequality in our region. So there is greater focus about the need and demand that we have. Infrastructure Australia has played a really important role in highlighting these various systems as part of the network, and I think in their recent Infrastructure Australia report, calling those out separately has been quite helpful at a national level, raising the bar. But increasingly we are finding that from a pure resilience perspective and what people and communities need, roads and bridges get a lot of press.
Yes, they do, don't they? The ribbon cutting idea.
And oftentimes, if that's, you know, the flavour of the day, that's what's being spoken about. There's not all that much excitement when you open a new sewage treatment facility.
No.
Roads, you know, that are going to carry new traffic or reduce travel time to getting home, or, you know, large metros that are going to carry a whole number of different people.
Oh, that's fantastic. And so with the member, you know, you actually mentioned Infrastructure Australia. How closely do you work with that body?
We work quite closely with Infrastructure Australia. We were very involved in the initial audit, and then through the development of the next infrastructure plan. It was highly collaborative. Lots of engagement, so there were plenty of consultations, opportunities to get engaged in shaping that report. And we were delighted last year in April when they launched their sustainability principles, which are going to start guiding decision making, because they align directly with the way in which we consider sustainability, and our rating tool is actually structured across governance, economic, social, and environmental.
So is that an influence that you've had on them?
I think that they were certainly well-informed and well-advised, and many of our members participated in that wide engagement as well as ourselves. So I think that Infrastructure Australia certainly listened to the feedback that they were getting, and that's been played back to us in the IA plan.
It's like sustainability is a concept whose time has come, isn't it? And you can't look at anything in our world really without understanding that it's got to be sustainable and efficient and deliver for people and country, as our Indigenous people say, and they seem to have it right. So it's really good to see all of that. Now, I just wanted to ask a little bit more about your members. You know, what's their interest? You know, what are their priorities? You mentioned a really diverse range of interests there too, which is, you know, finances as well. It all makes sense when I think about it. But what do you think their priorities are? And I guess you'd know that through your consultation with them. What are they most keen on?
Oftentimes change is driven by things that are challenging at the time. Some of those major challenges at the moment for all of our members, no matter where they are in that value chain, are climate change, digital and technology, and the speed at which things need to happen. Never have we had such an accelerated pipeline around expectations and delivery. And then importantly, also the skills shortages. Increasingly, there are also supply chain challenges in delivering some of the major materials that we need for some of the infrastructure that's currently underway. So from a trends perspective, those are absolutely the most pressing priority for our members. But equally, they're all recognising that for a long time, and we've spoken about this in the past, Tina, sustainability has been too hard, too soft, too costly, going to delay program. There wasn't that comprehensive understanding that everything is actually very interconnected and it can be a more systemic approach. But now it is becoming a business imperative. Mm. Shareholders are expecting it. Stakeholders are expecting it. Employees are almost demanding it and making choices about where they choose to volunteer their time for work. So it is becoming commercially quite an important issue. And over the last two AGM seasons, ESG has certainly been the flavour of the day in all of the more pointy questions. So for our membership, they each got slightly different challenges. We meet people where they are, and there is a level of support for whichever part of the value chain you come from and also where you're starting. Some are just taking tiny steps. Others are making giant strides, and it doesn't really matter where you start, rather that you just get started. So there's opportunities for demand side to get involved, supply chain to get involved, and then our role is really doing the business of our business. We measure what matters. We reward that kind of behaviour that reinforces more of the same kind of change practices, which is really in line with our purpose, which is ensuring all infrastructure delivers social, cultural, environmental and economic returns. And it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive.
Mm. So, you know, we have Infrastructure Australia that delivers the kind of priorities for the country. And obviously that's hugely important in your industry. And then you've got the, you know, the Sustainable Infrastructure Council. So, you know, how does one layer work with the other one? So, for instance, you've got a big engineering company and they're going to, you know, embark on a big project. How do you get your layering on top of their priorities? How do members tend to work? Do they voluntarily kind of, you know, assume certain set of priorities when they're embarking on their projects? What's the process there?
The way in which most projects engage with us is through a number of different levers. There's policy, there's planning, there's procurement, and there is investment practice. If you just referring to the infrastructure priority list, we're rating about 70% of the projects coming through that list. And the balance of those are where the policy planning, procurement, investment practices aren't yet in place. So some examples of that, Tina, from a policy perspective, almost all of the state and territory transport agencies and also some of those over in Aotearoa, New Zealand, which, because we work across both jurisdictions, all of them have got contractual thresholds. When they are going to be delivering infrastructure over a certain capex, that then triggers sustainability performance reporting and measurement on that asset. That almost always, that is using the infrastructure sustainability rating scheme.
So who it's triggered within the contract itself in the it's a performance measure.
It's a performance measure.
Oh, that's great.
It starts with policy though. So the majority of our government stakeholders are using that as a threshold capital value, but also some private stakeholders. And a great example of that is Transurban. That then translates into procurement practices. So project teams, delivery partners are expected to measure and report on their sustainability performance. And then that those outcomes are third-party assured by the IS Council. Mm. Equally, that can be triggered through the planning regime. So in New South Wales, the Department of Planning and Environment do require critical state infrastructure to measure their performance, all state critical infrastructure. So it then becomes a condition of their planning approval. We're also starting to see more in terms of investment practices. And there are a whole variety of examples there that are publicly available. One of them is Moorebank Intermodal, where the clean energy...
Sorry, what was that? The who?
Moorebank Intermodal.
Okay.
The logistics facility. So the Clean Energy Finance Corporation have got a $150 million debt facility on that. And in this instance, the rating scheme is being used to assure their carbon abatement outcomes. Recently, Reliance Rail announced a sustainability-linked loan, and they're going to be using our rating scheme for the operational performance measurement of their rail initiative, and making sure that again that performance is being measured and reported, and that's the way in which that particular finance mechanism is being assured. So yeah, those are the different ways that organizations would become involved in our rating scheme.
Mm, that sounds very encouraging, actually, and certainly much more organized and positive than perhaps in the property industry, where you've got this sort of voluntary assumption, take up of green buildings at the very top end with the premium property owners. But we're not so sure what's going on with the other 80% who may not be quite as engaged. So this sounds like it's quite, sounds like there is some hope for strong achievements and outcomes. So we're at the moment organising an event, probably people listening to the podcast might hear it after the event, but it's called Urban Greening. And we embarked on that really not knowing that much about it and thinking it's a bit early days for a really strong priority on green infrastructure and green outcomes. But in fact, it seems to be a really fast emerging area. And especially I'm thinking with, the high level investors and infrastructure companies involved in delivering in your sector, they would be probably up with the very sort of interesting latest trends that are going on for nature positive, which is what we're sort of starting to grasp. Actually, the task force on the nature-related task force of financial disclosure, which sounds really, really, really interesting. And a recent article in the media, just was saying it's going to move a lot faster than net zero. It's going to be more disruptive. We've got Pollination coming to our event. We've interviewed them before as well. They're just saying this is going to be a really big thing. So are you seeing evidence of the net nature positive ideas coming through in your sector?
Oh, absolutely, Tina. I would say that those natural systems are really important in providing ecosystem services, but also in addressing some of the nature-based solutions towards net zero. It's one of the things that we highlighted in our place-based approaches to net zero report released a little earlier this year in March. It is specifically called out. It is talking to some of those disclosures that are going to be becoming, but I think it's also really important to recognise that those contributions are going to be fundamental. We have to balance the social and the environmental, and indeed from a place perspective, these kind of opportunities are measured within our scheme actually in the governance category. It's taken a different order of perspective rather than simply looking at the environmental considerations. It's also about the contribution that those kind of solutions have to a particular place.
Okay, so earlier you mentioned some of the challenges for your members, including the lack of skills and also supply chain. Supply chain has become a really big thing, obviously, and I don't think we've been aware of where our materials are coming from. For instance, we recently discovered that 40% of Australia's LVL timber comes from Russia, and also some of its aluminium. What are some of the issues that your members are discovering with the supply chain, and how vulnerable are we going forward?
Those are certainly some of them. Some of the clinker that's in our concrete is equally quite challenging. The most significant materials in infrastructure are steel, concrete, timber, asphalt, and in all instances, we do import some of those materials. We're fortunate that many can also be manufactured and are being manufactured locally. But I think through all of the crises that we've experienced over the past 2 years, we've identified that there are actually quite significant challenges to the resilience of our supply chains. And we don't always look at that in a holistic way. So our members are starting to do that on multiple fronts. One of the examples is modern slavery legislation that came in some time ago. We have a coalition that is working together so that we are more efficient in how we manage those kind of reporting requirements, but more importantly, some of the responses, the implementation, identification, and engaging supply chains. But those are certainly challenges. Through COVID, there were certainly quite considerable delays and foreseeable delays in some instances. And how we might
some of the specifics, Ainsley, that in terms of the supply chain challenges that you've got in modern slavery, where are the most specifically the vulnerabilities?
So clinker would be one of the big ones, the primary constituent of concrete. I'm certainly no expert, Tina, on this front, but the majority of our clinker does get sourced from Southeast Asia. And
what is clinker, by the way? I don't know what it is. I realised. I've heard it plenty of times, but
I wouldn't have the chemical constituents for you, but it is one of the primary ingredients.
Sorry, something's happened to the sound there, so we might have to just repeat that. So, Ainsley, what is clinker? I'm not quite sure I know what it is.
I'm no expert, so I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer that with a whole lot of confidence for you, other than it is one of the primary ingredients of concrete. And it's a calciferous material as far as I know. But
and it comes from Southeast Asia.
The majority of clinker that is
in
concrete is largely sourced from Southeast Asia. Our members are looking at how they might manage clinker, but this is probably not a topic that I'm filled with confidence.
No, that's okay. But in general, so the supply chain is being concerned. I'm just wondering if there are any other specifics that you can point to. But, in general, so the modern slavery is obviously a constraint that people need to be aware of, and also the actual physical ability to actually bring materials in with China, sort of not engaging so much with Australia, and shipping sort of containers being in short supply, all sorts of issues like that. So that's actually affected your members as well, all of those.
It certainly has. All of those materials, some are locally manufactured, but certainly not the volumes that we are expecting to be inputting into our infrastructure pipeline over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. So what's the outlook for the cost of materials? And also you mentioned lack of skills. I imagine that's going to push costs up as well. Are your members factoring in significant inflation there? And
So most hold their commercial cards quite close to their chest, but at the moment it would seem that certain products and materials are blowing cost estimates out anything from 30 to 40%, some of them even higher. The skill shortage is equally creating a major concern in terms of labour supply and the ability to deliver on contracts. Some of our projects have gone from what we would expect to be a 12-month timeframe to 18 or 24 months. So there's huge delays, and those delays obviously incur escalation. As I mentioned, commercially, it's quite held quite close to their chest, but there are inflationary pressures. Some of the materials have jumped through the roof, and that's putting huge pressure on delivery timeframes and particularly the budgets. But the outlook is that is going to continue, and we're going to need a lot more collaborative practices to overcome some of those.
Yes, it's a bit of a problem all round, but now the latest thing I'm reading in the financial press is that the markets are actually calmed by the fact that the reserve banks in Australia and, well, the US mostly, doing aggressive rate hikes, because it means that maybe they won't hike so much in the future. It's really an extraordinary thing to be watching the economy at the moment and the supply chain constraints. Now, the New South Wales government also put on hold a couple of projects as well because of these issues, I think. But, you know, infrastructure is obviously a very important part of the economy, especially in tough times, and the government rolls out bigger projects. I'm also sort of noticed that you said earlier that regional areas are important and part of the infrastructure. So what are the kind of projects that can actually deliver outcomes in regional areas that your members are working on?
Well, I think if you have a look at some of the inequalities in regional areas, that often points to some of the immediate infrastructure solutions that might be appropriate. So across Australia, there are certain regions that are still experiencing energy poverty, water poverty, but equally there are some major transport challenges. And while in cities there are often debates about whether we need roads or rail or more passive forms of transport, in some regions, those forms of transport are actually really critical to get people from A to B, making sure that they've got access to all of the food supply, logistic chains. So it does depend on how regions are growing. And I think we've seen our demographics have started shifting, our population dynamics have started shifting over the past 2 years. So it's really important that we look quite closely at regional growth and what those communities might need in future, where there hasn't necessarily been ongoing investment in their aging infrastructure that perhaps is no longer fit for purpose.
Yeah, there's some huge challenges there. And I suppose one of the ideas that I've had sort of going into outback areas where, you know, the guy comes in from some large tourism organisation and says, oh, well, we've got to upgrade all the roads here and we've got to upgrade the facilities to make them all sort of nice and modern, you know, so we need the proper sleeping facilities and the cooking facilities and the bathroom. And I'm going, well, hang on a minute, I can get all that at home. Why do you need to do that out here? And he said, oh, well, if we don't do that, our overseas tourists won't come, you know. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, can we overdo infrastructure? What do you think, Ainsley? Can we sort of, you know, make too many connections? Do we really need a fantastic cappuccino at Fitzroy Crossing?
That's
a piece of social infrastructure, I suppose.
Well, I think that is probably depending on the target market that particular tourist facility is targeting. But when it comes to communities, we are in a developed country. And I think that there is a minimum level of service that would be appropriate for all of our communities, whether they are remote or regional or urban. The level of expectation certainly differs, but I think that we do need to take a critical look at what minimum service is required for all Australians.
I suppose the other side of that too, with all this rain that's been happening and people being flooded over and over, we're actually working on a story right now. So here we are in early July talking about this, just to give it a timing sense in 2022. And some people have been flooded 3 and sometimes 4 times. Are your members and organisation looking at what happens to the future of our regions in terms of livability? Are you looking at what we need to do to protect ourselves from, you know, violent weather whether it be flood or fire or heat?
Through the work that we do, Tina, resilience is a really critical part of...
Sorry, would you mind starting that again, Ainsley? The sound dropped out again.
No. Am I back?
Yes, you're back, yeah.
Thanks. So through the work that we do, resilience is a critical part of the infrastructure sustainability rating scheme. It falls within the governance section right alongside leadership and procurement as well as innovation. So it's actually really critical for infrastructure, and it is about cumulative resilience. So when we think about resilience, we don't think about the asset in and of itself. So how resilient is this single road connecting this community with the national highway, or this particular water supply chain in and out of a particular community? It's what resilience does that enable? So when communities are cut off by fire or flood, or don't have access to basic services, it is actually that cumulative impact that is considered. And that is, it's not traditional practice. It isn't something that we've had to think about in the past. Most often we haven't modelled all of these shocks and stresses all happening at the same time. But that's been our reality for the last 2 years. We haven't thought about both the extreme weather events, the fact that there might be serious geopolitical issues. We might also have major epidemic or pandemic health concerns. The modelling hasn't looked at that. History certainly provides a great timeline, but the frequency and the intensity of some of those things haven't been top priority, or at least not top priority. They haven't been the traditional way that we've considered things.
That's incredible. You've just made me realise how critical and important the infrastructure sector will be to our future. You know, it was only 4 or 5 years ago that New South Wales was considering evacuating 90 towns. And that's just, you know, La Nina came along, I think, in a time frame of a week before they started doing that. They had really literally run out of water, and people were using desalination plants to drink. I mean, that's no way to live, to be able to, you know, eke out a couple of litres of water so you can drink from the facility that they put in place, the portable desalination unit. This is incredible because, we're looking now, we're sort of talking to people about the possibility that whole communities won't be able to continue living where they are. And infrastructure is obviously going to be key to that. So there's a lot of weight on your shoulders coming up, isn't there, Ainsley, on you and your members?
There is certainly a lot of opportunities to think better.
Sorry, you'll have to repeat that. The sound keeps fading. I don't know why.
Tina, I think it's fair to say that there is a lot of opportunity to think better.
Yeah. That's a very positive way to look at it. And so another question, sort of going back to sort of a more conventional framing, is some of the infrastructure we've had has certainly not been wanted by some people in the inner west of Sydney, for instance, the West Connects. And I had an engineer, a couple of engineers come to visit me with a very high-profile media manager at one point and saying, you know, how can we get community, engagement and buy-in with these projects? And I said, well, have you actually asked the community whether they want it first? How do you deal with those problems? You know, what have you got to share along those lines about actually sort of, you know, is it something that the government should decide for all in the way that it used to, or is it, you know, can you get community buy-in for projects like you do with new sort of buildings, for instance, which is far, you know, much smaller scale?
With increased intergovernmental connection and coordination, I think that we will see a change in the way in which we engage communities. Never have I heard any project engage too early or engage too much with communities. They can get over consulted, but oftentimes that's slightly further down the train. And I have seen a noticeable change in the way in which infrastructure needs are being documented, how they're being identified, how they're being planned. It is happening earlier. It is happening more often. It's not perfect yet, Tina. I think we've still got a long way to go. But I do believe that there is far more emphasis being placed on the fact that we do need social license for all forms of activity, be that just being a commercial entity. It could be as an infrastructure owner operator. It could be the contractor that's busy, putting up a new telephone pole or installing a new NBN cable. But no matter where you are in the infrastructure network, understanding who you're working with and who you're working for is really important. So all of those, we're fortunate to have in our member base, regularly get involved and have information shared with them and reminded of the purpose. Infrastructure is delivered by people for people. So being more connected with them is useful, and having local government help raise up the initiatives about the kind of demand that there is and what their communities really need, I think will bring a whole new level of strength to how we service our community.
That's fantastic. One of the terms that's coming up in the urban greening event that we're doing is green infrastructure, and people have mentioned sort of programs to plant more trees in certain communities, and the neighbours will, the residents will come out and say, no, I do not want that tree outside my house. You are not planting a tree. So they're afraid of branches falling. They're afraid of the footpath being ripped up. But there's a whole lot of things that apparently they I didn't know either. But a tree, apparently, if it's not properly watered, will actually seek moisture under the pavement, especially in winter where the droplets collect. And that's why it breaks through the pavement. So if it's not watered properly, it'll actually misbehave, just like anything, really. So you think of a puppy or something that's not properly trained, or given what it needs, it will misbehave. And then one of the solutions that they've come up with is actually sort of knocking on the door and saying, can we put a tree outside your house? And if so, what kind of a tree would you like? And that can make a big difference.
It certainly does make a difference. In my local council, we got asked if we'd like a tree, and if we would like a tree, what tree we would like. And we had.
Oh, that's nice.
And I think there's huge power in having choice.
Yes.
One, don't you? If you do, yeah. What would you like? And I think that holds true for almost everything. It's the practice that we encourage is having really clear what's negotiable and what's not. And I think that power of choice makes all the difference when you are engaging with people, engaging with them on things where there is no choice is always going to lead to disappointment.
Yes, it certainly is. It's like, why bother asking me if you're going to go ahead and do it?
You're never going to get mild consensus if there's no choice.
Exactly. And the other thing is that they've discovered that if they do get the community engaged, they'll actually look after the trees. And I think it's South Australia. We're getting someone from South Australia to come and talk about this. But, they're saying, they're getting, thousands of hours of free labour. So you need to that's got a value, getting the community engaged, and they're enthusiastic to look after their natural environment, and they'll do it for nothing because they're getting pleasure out of it. Isn't that incredible? I love that.
I love the social awareness about sustainability. And
yeah, it is wonderful. It is positive the way the world's changing in so many ways, despite the fact that we have got very big challenges that are driving this change. So we've sort of talked about a lot of things, Ainsley. Are there some other issues that, that pop up in your mind that are, important in this sector and that we should be aware of, and perhaps you can communicate to our listeners?
Tina, I think we would be amiss if we didn't talk about emissions. 70% of Australia's emissions are enabled by infrastructure. So this
that's a big number.
It's a very big number, but it's also a very big opportunity. It's an opportunity for us to deliver on all of those commitments that we've made and our global obligations and responsibilities to deliver net zero by 2050. And limit global warming by 1.5 degrees. And infrastructure plays a really important part in doing that. Transport alone is estimated to about 18% of our emissions, and that's set to rise to up to 100 million tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent by 2030 if we don't start making changes. We are making progress in infrastructure. Of the 25 projects which we certified last year, we achieved a 43% reduction in emissions for life cycle energy and that's from normal traditional business as usual practices. We also achieved a 56% reduction in materials emissions. So that's quite considerable emission reduction avoidance that's been possible. And it's quite critical to call out that that is what's possible when the whole value chain is aligned. There are really clear targets and it is consistently communicated about what is required and why it's required. That wouldn't be delivered in the absence of those levers that I mentioned earlier. In this instance, it's been policy and really aligned procurement.
That's fantastic.
In terms of what our members can directly control and influence, the areas that they're most interested in typically tend to be operational and embodied energy, because the planning for all of the enabled emissions or those user-based emissions often take place way before they're actually involved in designing or delivering or operating an asset. So embodied energy is quite an important part of the mix. That contributes about 6% to that overall 70% that I mentioned. And the most engaged and largest organizations in our membership are very focused on that. They've also joined initiatives like the IS Council has with the embodied the Materials Embodied Carbon Leaders Alliance, or MECLA, and that's really considering what we might do collectively to change policy, shift behaviours, focus on specifications and standards which are not enabling innovation, testing, experimenting. So there's been a huge amount of effort and energy invested in what we might do together. There's going to be a lot more to come. Several of the peak bodies that work in infrastructure are really keen to start advancing some of the great work that's been happening in a collaborative way over the past 2 years that builds on the work that's already been done. So we're going to be working with our members to advance a national net zero initiative, and there'll be a lot more to come on that front in the next few weeks and months.
That's very exciting to hear. Ainsley, thank you very much for this. It's been a really illuminating discussion and a very important part of our economy and our work in sustainability, I think, as a nation. So good on you for pushing that. By the way, just a little bit about your personal self. How long have you been there at the council?
Tina, I'm not the news.
We probably won't use this, but it might be a little bit of background, yeah. So no, that's okay. That's you
no, don't. No problem. I don't mind answering questions.
Yeah, because it's being a podcast, it is actually nice to get a bit of a personal view as well.
Yeah,
why are you there? You know, why are you at the Infrastructure Sustainability Council? What attracted you to the job?
So, Tina, I've been with the Infrastructure Sustainability Council for 6 years now, and I've had the privilege of leading my passionate team for the last four as CEO. I have always been interested and deeply connected to sustainability and the environment. It's where I started my career in environmental consulting. My first degree was in sustainable resource use.
Then I
went on to, in the bush carving industry in South Africa. So The bush carving industry.
Carving?
Bush carving.
What does that mean?
So, not bush carving, wood carving. Wood. Let me say that again.
Okay.
That's
unusual.
I did wonder how sustainable the industry was. So I did some research and I went and measured tree trunks to see whether or not trees were growing back as fast as they were being harvested for wood carvings, because it is one of the wonderful little trinkets that you might bring home from Africa, a wooden rhino or a wooden tortoise or a wooden giraffe if you're lucky to bring it in and have it gassed in Australian quarantine. Things are over 20 years ago now, they certainly weren't sustainable, and I imagine it's still the same. But a little bit about me, in terms of my passions, people, purpose, property, and all things sustainability. It's been like that since the earliest stage in my career. I started out in professional services and spent at least a decade in that. I have dabbled in the people and the plants, which are other passions, but been firmly committed to sustainability and the environment for a very long time. It brings me such joy to work with our members and to do more, to do better, and always investing in uplifting other people. You don't change behaviours by shaming or blaming or rolling your eyes. It's waiting for people to get ready.
How do you inspire them? What's your secret?
Well, I'll use an analogy, Tina, which I was reminded of recently, but working in sustainability is a little bit like a flash mob.
Flash mob?
Yeah, and not the really well-structured, well-choreographed YouTube Instagrammable ones. I'm thinking about like a genuine flash mob. You're in a public space. It's a beautiful setting. You hear a beat. You know, it sounds like your tune. You start dancing. You keep dancing. It changes a little bit, but it's still, you know, the rhythm's there for you and you keep dancing. Some people stand up, some people sit down. Sometimes you're alone, sometimes you're with others. But it's quite some time before there's enough of a crowd for you to sit down without them stopping. And it's a bit like that in sustainability. And for the team and I at the Infrastructure Sustainability Council, we just keep dancing.
That's fantastic. And what are the signs for you at the moment? What gives you encouragement?
The encouragement is the number of people stepping up to the starting blocks, the level of interest in what we do and willingness to learn, the recognition that we need to build bench strength. Sustainability is no longer going to be just one person's responsibility. Siloed in an organization. This is a team sport and everybody needs to know how to play, because no matter what discipline you're from, there is a contribution to be made. So I think that that's quite critical, and that's definitely been a big shift. For many, the maturity model of safety resonates quite strongly. It starts with compliance, then it becomes a competitive advantage, and then it leads to deep commitment. And that's happening at an organizational level. It starts at a personal level. It scales to organizational level. And I can see that that's happening across the sector that I serve.
That's really interesting that you said there's a competitive element that people go through and then they embrace it deeper. I've always thought the same thing. That's interesting you say that.
There's definitely a competitive edge to sustainability. Many of our founding members were first movers 10 years ago, even beyond that, when the initial idea for a rating scheme was born in 2008 by some really inspired and insightful visionary individuals in industry, which looked across to property and thought, why wouldn't we be doing that? This is equally right for our sector. So it's been around a while, but it certainly hasn't been trending. It hasn't been all that, I can't think of the right word now, but it certainly hasn't been mainstreaming for all that long. But now that it is becoming contractually required, it is becoming an expectation of shareholders. That's cascading through boards, through ELTs, it's become KPIs. Most stations have got their senior leadership team requiring them to demonstrate what kind of performance they're demonstrating, what kind of leadership they're showing up with every day. So that competitive space is absolutely there. It's definitely a differentiator. If you can actually make clear through practical examples on a variety of different infrastructure assets, what is possible and what you've actually delivered, that is increasingly starting to have a much greater weighting at the tender box.
That's fantastic. And it sounds like there's some engagement with the property sector, and that's interesting. How deep does that engagement go?
It's certainly extending deep There is a lot to share. There are certainly many things that the property sector have done. They've tested, they've tried. They often share what the traps and the tricks are. That's useful. Infrastructure and property have got fundamentally slightly different drivers. So when people bait me to make comparisons, I often respond that comparison is the thief of joy.
Is it what?
Comparison is the thief of joy.
And yet the competitive spirit is so powerful.
I think that it can be very healthy, and it inspires you to do better. And but it, at the same time, it can be cooperative, and you can.
It might be, yeah.
You can follow a lead.
Are there certain people that you talk to more often than others in the property sector that you're closest to?
Without exception, I would have to say that Davina Rooney and I at the Green Building Council talk regularly. There is huge synergy equally with the New Zealand Green Building Council. What we do is united in purpose. How we do it can be slightly different. We can have healthy dialogue, but at the end, where we're going and the kind of outcomes that we're looking to deliver for our members are really aligned. So I'd have to say that they would be really equally yoked and probably one of our closest allies.
That's lovely. So you talked about growing up in South Africa. I'm just wondering, whereabouts in South Africa did you grow up, and what kind of generated your early interest in sustainability or the environmental issues?
So I was born and raised in Johannesburg, South Africa. I was really fortunate to be the only child of a single mum, and my grandmother raised me. She had a passion for gardening, which is probably where my interest in plants comes from. So I was always outdoors. I was always exploring the garden and dissecting the flowers. So that deep connection with nature started really early for me.
And who have been your inspirations over the years?
Oh, goodness. I'm inspired daily by anyone that I meet. There is always something to learn.
Yeah.
And if you listen long enough, there is gold in every conversation that you have.
What's that? Sorry, the sound faded again.
We might come back and do my little intro as well, because I think I completely fucked that up. So,
Ainsley, who are the people that have inspired you over the years? And I'm thinking of perhaps your early years and also more recently in your work. And you've said you speak a lot with Davina, but I'm wondering, are there people in the industry or the economy at the moment that are kind of leaders for you? Let's talk about that first, perhaps. And now you've frozen altogether.
Yeah, when I'm thinking.
Sorry, it wasn't the internet that time. That's so funny.
It wasn't the
internet. Yeah, so I'm just asking, who is sort of, who've been. So I'll start again. So, Ainsley, I'm just asking, who kind of inspire you, who inspires you at the moment in the industry or the economy? You know, does Mike Cannon-Brookes shine a light, for instance? Do you think he's sort of leading the charge? I mean, what is the impact of such a high-profile, wealthy person who strikes out against all the odds to challenge governments to do better and says, you know, rings up or tweets Elon Musk and says, we're going to build the biggest battery, aren't we? And we're going to do it before Christmas. I mean, I find that particularly amazing, and I think that that kind of galvanises a lot of following and interest. I'm particularly awed by people like that who really strike out on their own. And you also mentioned Twiggy Forrest, who's come from a mining background and suddenly decided he's going to go green. That must have a big impact in the world, I would think.
I think those big personalities can certainly change the game. The ones that are bold enough to set the cat amongst the pigeons and start the conversation going off in a completely different direction when perhaps something else was intended. And there's certainly more and more space and place for those kind of individuals. The ones that inspire me every day, Tina, are not always the big names. It's the people doing small, humble things that are making big impact without necessarily tweeting about it. Every day I meet incredible individuals that are doing what they can do within their realm of influence and reaching for goals and collaborating on goals that are much bigger than they can achieve on their own. And those are the people that I am inspired by the most.
The quietly courageous, I've seen a lot of them too through our work. There was a woman, she's a scientist. Actually, she works in one of the big accounting firms now, but I saw her give a speech and it was really based on her PhD, and she actually looked into local government areas to find out where the ideas came from to create climate policies and resilience policies. And inevitably, it was a single person on their own working against all the odds. It was just spine-chilling. In a positive way.
I will share with you, Tina, that I'm of the firm view that the next generation of executives are sustainability professionals.
Wow.
We've launched our Rise Mentoring Program to test this theory. But I think that sustainability professionals and especially the new graduates that I get to meet quite frequently through our membership have an inherent social conscience. And they have a level of influence that transcends their years. They take responsibility without having the title or the role or the authority to do it. But they engender such agency in getting things done. And I think that that level of influence is going to be quite an important skill, a leadership quality for the future. But more importantly, they actually understand how to deliver the social, environmental, economic, and cultural outcomes that we're going to need for a sustainable future, a positive future, one that serves everybody and leaves no one behind. So I think we should watch this space. It's a hypothesis I'm really hoping does come to the fore and is proven to be correct.
I think you're right. They're incredibly well-rounded, the young people. The young professionals coming through are amazing. I agree with you. Anyway, I think that's a really good place to leave it. Thank you very much, Ashley.
Tina, if it's all right with you, I'm going to give my bio a shot one more time.
Your what? Your what?
My bio a shot one more time. You asked me about me.
Please do. Because I think, you know, we can edit this. And I really did want to, I'm afraid we sort of do things on the rush a lot, on the run, and sometimes this can happen. But I would be interested to know a little bit more about your background, Ainsley. Would you share that with me?
Thanks, Tina. I have been with the Infrastructure Sustainability Council 6 years now, and it's been an incredibly happy landing. I've had the privilege of leading the team as CEO for the last four. Prior to that, I've always had a strong interest and passion in sustainability. It's been a really big part of my professional life and my career, starting in the early days as an environmental consultant, and then moving through research consultancy and more consultancy, and now landing with a not-for-profit. My education and qualifications started off in science before there was a thing called sustainability. I did my master's, or at least my honours project, looking at the sustainability of the wood carving industry in South Africa. Wasn't sustainable then, and it's probably not sustainable now. And then also did my master's in business before starting to look at some of the more commercial roles that were available. I think the fascinating thing about the sustainability industry is how many different roles there are and the variety of different opportunities that you get exposed to.
Mm. They're almost taking over everything, everywhere that we can look at the moment, aren't they? And so they should.
So they should, and we need more of them.
Absolutely. So thanks very much, Ainsley, again, CEO of the infrastructure. No, let me get that right.
You have to ask me the utopia question together. When I saw that one,
I forgot.
I'm going to give a very diplomatic answer, but
no. Okay, that was good. Okay, so hang on. What is my utopia question? I forgot about it. I always have these at the end.
I love that we were going to end on it.
Okay, so Ainsley, we've talked about a lot of issues that are confronting your members and confronting the industry and the challenges ahead. But, you know, I've often been, concerned. Let me start again. So there's a lot of issues that are confronting the industry, and we've gone through a whole lot of them at the moment, and big decisions to be made. Infrastructure is a big part of the economy. Sustainability is a huge challenge. But how do these decisions get made? And quite frankly, is the TV show Utopia correct?
I'm going to rely on recency syndrome on the Utopia one. All of the government departments and officials that we've been delivering projects with and for have been pragmatic and really outcomes focused.
That's way too diplomatic, Ainsley. I'm sure you can do something more entertaining.
Tina, what I will say is that I'm still holding out to be invited to a thought picnic.
To the what?
To a thought picnic.
A thought picnic.
Do you remember that in the Utopian series?
I can't remember that one. So let me say that again. You're still, you know.
We're waking up.
Yeah, I know. We've got terrible connections today. So about Utopia, were they correct?
Well, recency syndrome will serve me in that most of the government officials we're working with delivering projects with and for have been really pragmatic and outcome focused. I am still holding out for an invitation to one of those magical thought picnics.
That's fantastic and very diplomatic. Thank you very much, Ainsley.